Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ted Williams, the Boston Red Sox slugger who announced as a young ball player that he wanted to be known as the greatest hitter who ever lived and then spent 19 seasons staking a convincing claim on that distinction, died yesterday in Crystal River, Florida, of cardiac arrest. Williams had suffered several strokes over the past few years. He was 83 years old. In 1941, Ted Williams hit 406. Nobody has hit over 400 since. If the figure is arbitrary, it's also magical in the way that some statistics simply are. As the years have gone by, the stature of Ted Williams has grown as generations of superb hitters have seemed briefly to challenge his achievement and then fallen short. Like many ballplayers of his generation, Williams would have left behind even more impressive numbers if he hadn't served his country during the Second World War and the Korean War. Unlike many of those ballplayers, Williams served as a fighter pilot, and he was, by all accounts, superb at that work as well. Temperamental and sometimes even abusive as a young man, Williams eventually came to accept how important what he had done had become to people who loved the game that he loved. Late in his life, he accepted their appreciation and their affection. Almost 9 years ago, on the occasion of Ted Williams' 75th birthday, I sat for a time in the Red Sox dugout at Fenway Park with Johnny Pesky, who was Ted Williams' teammate for 8 seasons and has since served the Red Sox for half a century as a coach, manager, broadcaster, and fungo hitter. Pesky must have learned something from the master, as he led the American League in hits 3 times. I began my conversation with Johnny Pesky by asking if Ted Williams was the best hitter ever.
Without a doubt, the best ever. In my recollection, I didn't see Ruth and Gehrig and Gehringer and those fellas. But the man did everything possible for baseball, plus going into the service. He missed 5 years. There's no telling how many records he could have broken, you know, if he didn't miss all that time because of the war. He was God's gift to baseball. He had great eyesight, he had quickness, he had size, strength, and a dominating personality. And all the guys in the ball club thought a lot of him, liked him.
Does he ever talk about how many records he could have broken?
No, he was just concerned about every day. He'd come out, the first thing he'd ever do, Bill, he'd come out here and he'd look at the flag to see which way it was blowing. If it was blowing out, boy, he said, oh, baby, I'll get one up in the wind today. And he was always willing to help, but he was the type of guy, he wouldn't go to you, you'd have to go to him. But if anybody knew anything about hitting, he did. He just made a study of it. He was that way with everything he ever did. He became a great fisherman. He read a lot. Unusual.
As a teammate and as somebody who saw teammates come and go while Williams played, was there ever a sense among the other players of sort of shaking their heads and saying, you know, I could ask him 1,000 questions and practice for 100 years and I still couldn't do the things he can do and make look so natural?
Well, I think a lot of guys did go to him, Bill, in those years. I recall a story right here in this ballpark. It was right after the war again. We got off to such a great start that year. And Bobby Dorr was really struggling. And Dominic and I and Bobby were sitting right here in this area, right here where we are now. And Ted came down, and of course Bobby was standing up. We were getting ready to go for batting practice. And here comes Ted, and he said hi, and then he stood up right on the top up there, and he says, Bobby, he says, get up here. He says, my God, he says, one day you got the bat like the Statue of Liberty. You're open, you're closed, your feet together, feet apart. He says, get a nice clean stance and get comfortable with it and give it a try. And, of course, Ted is so animated anyway. And of course, Bobby looked him right in the eye and he says, well, I can't do the things you can do. And he threw his arms up and stomped off. He says, if you want to be a lousy 280 hitter, be a lousy 280 hitter.
Can you remember a time when you ever went to him for help or when he ever offered you help, specific occasion?
Sure. I remember one day we had a guy out there and the count on me was 2-2 and for some reason my mind went a blank and he's in the on deck, and I called time, and I took about five steps, and I called to him, and I says, so what is this guy going to throw? He says, oh, my God, he went into orbit. He says, see the ball and just hit it. Luckily, I got a base hit, and I think he hit a ball in the bullpen or something, right? But sometimes I'd ask him stupid questions, and he'd look at me, and he'd shake his head, and he'd say, oh, my God. But I think he kind of liked me a little bit, because I loved him, and he was always real close to Bobby and Dominic and myself. He's just a fine guy.
I never heard too many people down on the field say bad things about him. The writers, through periods of time, had some nasty things to say about him. Did you ever have the feeling that he read that stuff and let it get to him?
Well, I think it did at one time, especially when he was a lot younger. You know, the year I got here, the year before, he had 406. And he had a couple of guys that were on his case. And then I think in 41, when he hit the 406, one of the local writers didn't even put him in the top 10, and he missed out losing the MVP award by 1 point. Well, that's ridiculous. I think when you're a writer, you have to be fair with yourself. And here's one of the best players in the world, and you don't vote for him, you've got to vote him at least in the top five.
But Williams was perhaps the very best hitter of them all.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he came up announcing to everybody within hearing distance that he intended to be known as the greatest hitter who ever lived.
Right.
Do you feel like that generally happened?
Oh, sure. Sure. No one compares to him. We've had guys threaten to hit 400. I think George Brett one year was close, and Carew was close. Billy Williams over in the other league at the time was close to 400. He wound up hitting about 360. But I've been around here over 40 years, and I've never seen anybody like him.
Thanks very much for talking with us, John.
Oh, my pleasure. You're talking about my man. When it comes to my man, I'm available.
Johnny Pesky speaking with me in 1993, just before the 75th birthday of the greatest hitter who ever lived. Ted Williams died yesterday in Crystal River, Florida. He was 83 years old. In 1941, Ted Williams ended the All-Star game by whacking a two-out, three-run home run out of Detroit's Briggs Stadium to hang a 7-5 loss on the National League. On Tuesday night, once again, the best American League players will battle the Titans of the National League, this time in one of baseball's several new show places, Miller Park in Milwaukee. Assuming the game lives up to its billing, it'll be an odd spectacle for Milwaukee fans who've had little experience watching good baseball lately. Chuck Quirnbeck of Wisconsin Public Radio has this report.
Bratwursts sizzle on one of the many grills set up in Miller Park's massive parking lot before a recent game between the Brewers and Minnesota Twins. Many here seem happy just to hold tailgate parties, as fans did for decades outside the now-torn-down Milwaukee County Stadium. Tailgater Tom Oskey wishes the Brewers were playing better, but he says for now he's not upset that some of his tax dollars are going to help what may be the worst team in the Brewers' 32-year history.
I mean, some seasons are down seasons and some aren't. So, you know, I mean, it'll bother me if it's 4 years from now and they still haven't done anything. But at this point, you know, somebody has to have the worst record in the league, I guess.
Inside Miller Park, you can also find fans who are trying to look on the bright side. On this night, two young women, Megan and Mindy, have section 407 of the upper deck to themselves. Both say they still come to Brewers games because they love baseball. And the smaller crowds this year suit them just fine.
You don't have, like, rowdy people, like, screaming in your ears or anything?
Well, you don't have to be, like, moving for the other people, like, when they're, like, if they're trying to get in your aisle or something.
But in one of Miller Park's designated smoking areas, fans gather in a hallway for a cigarette or two and complain about the team. A young woman who calls herself Erin says she doesn't know why the Brewers can't just go out and buy all the good baseball players. Erin works at a local Hooters restaurant, where a positive approach is practically part of the job description. She says the Brewers' current players, including outfielder Matt Stairs, need to change their on-field attitudes.
Get your players a little more into it. Make them look like they're having fun. Because I watch, like, we're in right field right now, and I'm watching Stairs, and he doesn't even look like he's having a good time.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Brewers first baseman Richie Sexson and shortstop Jose Hernandez have been named to the National League All-Star team. But at most home games, the biggest cheer seems to be for the sausage race, featuring four people dressed as a bratwurst, Polish and Italian sausages, and a hot dog. The team says it's well aware that even costumed sausages might not be enough to draw fans to see a cellar dweller after the All-Star break. So the Brewers have lined up a long list of promotional events for future games. Brewers Marketing Vice President Laurel Priebe is also the husband of team president Wendy Selig and is the son-in-law of Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig. Priebe says the occasional sausage race will even be complemented by a Mr. Potato Head giveaway night.
Kids have grown up for how many generations with it? I remember it as old as I am. And that really says something to the staying power of Mr. Potato Head.
Priebe says the Brewers may exhibit that kind of staying power and still draw 2 million fans this year. That'd be a drop in attendance of 800,000 from last year's inaugural season at Miller Park, but it would still be the third largest fan total in team history. Priebe says if the Brewers are more competitive in subsequent years, they can get back up to about 2.5 million customers. A 20-something fan named Jordan seems especially eager for the Brewers to succeed and give fans a reason to visit Miller Park.
Yeah, they need to put some W's up and have the World Series at this thing, because that's how beautiful it is.
On Tuesday evening, the stadium will have to settle for being the site of Major League Baseball's 73rd All-Star Game. For Only a Game, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. When Freddie Martin Dye of Guildford, Surrey in England was 7 years old, he enjoyed go-karting about the family farm. On a lark, his dad made a 1,000-pound wager with William Hill Bookmakers, which agreed to pay Mr. Martin Dye £1 million if little Freddie grew up to win a Formula One Grand Prix race. Now 13, Freddie is ranked third in the British Championships for junior professional kart racing, and he has a contract with the Ricky Flynn Motorsport team. It would still be a bit of a jump to a Grand Prix win, but a spokesperson for William Hill acknowledged that, quote, "We are rather mopping our brows at the thought of such a hefty payout." She loves me now, but she's gonna love me more. So I gotta drive like I never drove before.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. To read more about the death of Red Sox legend Ted Williams and reaction to it in a special report by Bill Littlefield, log on to our website, wbur.org. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. By North Shore Magnetic Imaging Center, providing MRI services for over 14 years, with locations in Peabody, Beverly, and Salem. Information available at 800-540-8960. And by A Street Frames, 21 years of frame making for galleries, artists, and the public, offering museum-quality framing and professional advice in Cambridge near Fresh Pond and in Boston's South End. astreetframes.com. 68 degrees in Boston as we come up on 720.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the boss of the Meadowlands and beyond. And we're not talking Springsteen. But first, the Tour de France begins this weekend. U.S. cyclist Lance Armstrong, seeking his fourth straight title, is among the favorites. Armstrong will not have to worry about top German cyclist Jan Ulrich, who recently tested positive for amphetamines while training after a knee injury, or about French rider Laurent Pommier, who was dropped from the race after testing positive for corticosteroids. As Ian Austin of the CBC in Ottawa reports, despite assurances from those who run the race, drugging continues to be a major concern of those who follow the tour.
Vans carrying go-go dancers race ahead of the riders, blasting music while the dancers are pushing cell phones. This is the 2001 Tour de France's publicity caravan. Hundreds of vehicles push products. no decoration is too bizarre. There's always a band playing. At the Tour de France, business is as big as sport. This band is promoting a French supermarket chain, while chickens, big as armchairs, roll past in giant grocery carts.
I think that the Tour de France is a circus, a magic circus.
Antoine Veillé trains professional cyclists. He's become a fierce critic of the sport.
This sport, the results means nothing. Maybe 15 or 20 years, you see, the results means nothing because of doping.
Veillé was the trainer of the Festina team, the first of a series of teams hauled off to jail during the 98 Tour.
And at a funereal pace, the Tour de France crosses the finishing line with the TVM riders subject to major drug investigations. Will the Tour de France be able to continue tomorrow morning?
The Tour did resume, but today as Lance Armstrong begins his attempt at a fourth victory in cycling's most famous race, questions concerning doping linger. And it's embittered Veillé, one of the few Festina team members whose name was cleared in court.
It has been proved that there was even some difference between a big or little rider who took the same dope. It made difference. But the one who don't dope can't have result. So this sport means nothing.
There's a lot of evidence to support his point of view. In May, the Tour of Italy, or Giro d'Italia, became something of a non-stop drug scandal. Police raids found three riders with drugs. Then, the race's leader and a former winner both tested positive for illegal substances. As in 98, most of the new allegations center around blood-boosting products, such as the hormone commonly called EPO or EPO. All this caused an Italian chemical company that bankrolls cycling's number one ranked team to announce that it's quitting cycling sponsorship later this year. The Italian affair probably means that Armstrong will once again face questions focusing on doping rather than cycling. Here's Armstrong at a 2001 press conference.
I think that cycling is on its way out of the crisis because they've done more than any other sport. Show me another sport that has approved a test for EPO and called people positive. There's nobody. There will always be people that don't want to believe that. But you've got to look at the facts.
Doping questions continue to be directly aimed at Armstrong, who survived cancer before going on to win his first Tour in 1999. Suspicions arose after a French TV crew recovered a bag of medical waste from a roadside garbage pit. It had been dumped by members of Armstrong's U.S. Postal Service team. Mixed in with the blood-soaked medical waste were 160 boxes for syringes and empty drug containers. Traces of Actovegin, which has since been banned as a blood doping product, were subsequently detected.
Have one in English.
Yeah.
You said English?
Yeah.
A French investigation into the garbage affair staggers on, although government officials now say that charges are unlikely. But during last year's Tour, it emerged that Armstrong had consulted Dr. Michele Ferrari. Over the past few months, an Italian court has heard testimony that Ferrari was at the center of a large doping ring. Armstrong, who always travels with a team of PR people, adamantly denies seeing Ferrari for anything illicit, just as he rejects any suggestions that he uses banned substances.
I believe he's a fair man, and I believe he's an innocent man. I've never seen anything to lead me believe otherwise. People are not stupid. People will look at the facts. They will say, okay, here's Lance Armstrong. Here's a relationship. Is that questionable? Perhaps. But people are smart. Do they say, has Lance Armstrong ever tested positive? No. Has Lance Armstrong been tested? A lot. Now, is there an EPO test? Absolutely. Will he pass every test because he does not take EPO? Yes, he will. I think the people believe in that.
At the end of every stage of the Tour de France, several riders give urine samples in a small trailer which waits at the finish line. Following this year's scandal in Italy, Tour de France organizers are boosting the number of samples they take and the tests they perform, particularly for EPO. There are, however, drugs such as human growth hormone that still defy testing. They include a synthetic variant of EPO known as NESP that appeared during the Salt Lake City Winter Olympic Games. Again, Lance Armstrong.
There's always going to be an evolution in the world of medicine. It's always going to be a tricky situation. When they find a test for one thing, then somebody stands out there and says, well, then you must be doing the next thing. When they find a test for that, then they say, well, you must be doing the next thing. it goes on and on and on. I can tell you that, you know, speaking of a substance like growth hormone, why would somebody in my position with my health history take something like that? There's no way.
In 3 weeks, when this year's Tour de France reaches its finish on the Champs-Élysées, there will again be large numbers of American fans. And with most of his potential rivals out of the race through injury or doping-related problems, it's likely that they'll again be cheering a victory by Armstrong. But with last year's cases not fully resolved, and doping allegations renewed by the recently concluded Giro d'Italia, it's unlikely that Armstrong will get there without having to deal with his least favorite topic of conversation. For Only a Game, I'm Ian Austin in Paris.
Tyrant, financial genius, convicted felon, sucker for lost causes, insufferable egomaniac, George Steinbrenner, the owner of the New York Yankees, may be all of these and more. Not surprisingly, the boss struck journalist John Cassidy as a splendid subject for a profile. Owning the Yankees, Mr. Cassidy's lengthy look at Mr. Steinbrenner appears in the current New Yorker magazine. John Cassidy joins me now from New York. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks for inviting me on. I'm glad to be here.
This is an ambitious piece, acknowledging that George Steinbrenner is a complex person, but I want to start by asking you how Mr. Steinbrenner is going to feel when he reads you referring to him as, quote, a fanatical pig-headed rich guy.
I don't know. I mean, he'd probably be a little angry, I would imagine, although I think if he took each of those adjectives in turn, he wouldn't be able to object too strongly. He's certainly fanatical. He's certainly rich, you know, and he's certainly a guy. So, I mean, Steinbrenner, I think, has, you know, some sort of reasonable view of himself. He knows he's a fanatic. I think he just thinks that's necessary to succeed, and everything, you know, everything else revolves around that.
There have been lots of wonders to behold and several disgraceful adventures as well during the 30 years that George Steinbrenner has owned the Yankees. Remarkably, the whole thing began with Steinbrenner's investment of less than $200,000 of his own money. How did he manage that?
Yeah, I mean, people don't realize that, I don't think. There's a sort of common misconception that George Steinbrenner was a very rich man before he bought the Yankees. He was well off. His family owned a shipping company in just outside Cleveland, but he wasn't very rich, and he didn't have enough money to buy the Yankees. CBS was selling the Yankees in 1973. They'd bought the team back in 1964 to try and raise ratings. Actually, the Yankees had some bad years, and CBS put the team up for sale for $10 million, which, you know, these days is peanuts, but back then was still considered a reasonable sum.
Won't buy you a decent hitter these days, right?
Exactly. I mean, but Steinbrenner couldn't raise that money himself, so he actually borrowed most of it, and he only put up about $165,000 himself. Now that's his stake. He's worth, you know, several hundred million dollars at least, so it was a remarkable investment. But to get hold of the Yankees for $165,000, I mean, that really is astonishing.
As you point out in the piece, though New Yorkers consider Mr. Steinbrenner a hero these days, 10 years ago when the Yankees were losing, he was pretty much generally regarded as a bum. If the Yankees don't win, say, at least one of the next four or five World Series, is he a bum again?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, that's New Yorkers. You know, when you're on top, they cheer you. When you're in the gutter, they step on your throat. So I think he realizes, and his managers realize, you know, that as long as they keep winning, he'll be on top. But should they start to lose again, sure, everybody will be saying what a monster he is. That's the bargain in New York, not just in baseball, in everything.
In considering the current success of the Yankees, you write, quote, to stay on top in any major sport, it is essential to maintain the true fanatic's warped sense of reality. Insecurity and paranoia are also big advantages. Do you think Mr. Steinbrenner would smile and agree with that?
Yeah, I think he would. I mean, he certainly didn't hide those facets when I was with him. I mean, you know, he looks on sport as war. I think I said that. He studies strategy books. He studies military history. He's a big fan of Churchill. I think he thinks, you know, that war is the metaphor that you need to run a successful sports club. And, you know, when you're running a war, you have to be fanatical. You have to look at every detail. I mean, I explain how he even gets involved in really trivial little issues like what type of soap and powder they use in the locker rooms and what type of towels they have. You know, I mean, you wouldn't believe the level of minutia which George Steinbrenner involves himself in. And I think, you know, his attitude is it's the details that matter. He has a saying, he says, you know, don't worry about the elephants, it's the mice that'll trip you up. I think he believes, you know, if you look after the details, the big things will take care of themselves.
You do mention in the profile that Mr. Steinbrenner reads Sun Tzu, the ancient Chinese military strategist. I'm curious, what else did you see on his bookshelves?
Well, he also is reading a lot of military history. He reads about the Civil War. He's a big fan of General Lee, who actually, you know, wasn't the most successful. But his argument is that Lee had a lot fewer resources than the Union side, and that actually, you know, if he'd have made a couple of different decisions at Gettysburg, the Union may have ended up losing. That was one of the things which surprised me about Steinbrenner. You don't get the impression from reading the sports page and seeing him on TV that, you know, he's a big reader of anything much, really. But actually he is, you know. And one of the other things I found out about him was that when he was a student, you know, he was a big reader of English literature. He wrote his senior thesis on Thomas Hardy's Romantic Heroines. I don't think that's the popular conception of Steinbrenner.
At one point, George Steinbrenner told you, quote, "What drives people into sports ownership is ego, 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 including myself." And I can't help asking whether you came away from your assignment liking him.
Yes, I did to some extent. I mean, the relationship between a journalist and somebody you're profiling is always somewhat artificial in that the person you're profiling wants you to like them. Obviously, they don't want you to write nasty things about them, so they tend to be nice to you. They tend to give you access, and Steinbrenner certainly did that. And, you know, he can be very pleasant company. Other people will tell you that. You know, he's very charming. He has great stories to tell, which as a journalist is, you know, that's like manna from heaven, somebody who can actually tell you good stories. So, you know, I did end up liking him. Yeah, I wouldn't like to work for him, though. I mean, I say in the piece that he divides the world into people who work for him and people who don't. I certainly wouldn't like to be, you know, working up at Yankee Stadium every day.
You conclude your piece with George Steinbrenner's contention that he will one day turn the Yankees over to his children, but none of the members of the next generation seems to care enough about that possibility to even return your calls. Do you think the boss ever will retire?
On numerous occasions, he'd start out the conversations by telling me how he was getting ready to retire and going to hand over things to his sons, etc. But there's no evidence of that if you actually look at how the club's working. I mean, he still comes into work every morning. He calls a manager and the general manager at all times of day and night. And his two sons don't even work at the Yankees. One of them looks after the stud farm and one of them is in real estate. So I think it's a big question, A, whether and when George will retire, and B, you know, who or what will take over after that. I mean, there's always the chance that the club could be sold, you know. Do I think Steinbrenner will actually retire? I very much doubt it. I mean, he strikes me as one of those domineering entrepreneurs who will retire in a coffin, really, to be blunt about it.
John Cassidy is the author of the lengthy profile of George Steinbrenner, which appears in the current New Yorker magazine. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to Only a Game. On Tuesday night, Barry Bonds, who temporarily holds the Major League record for home runs in a single season, did not hit one. Almost everybody else in the major leagues did. Tuesday night's game saw 53 hitters clock a record 62 dingers, an aggregation that broke the previous record for home runs in a single evening by five. Jay Gibbons of the Baltimore Orioles got credit for the record-breaking clout when his second home run in a game against Anaheim, number 58 of the night, left the yard. "That's kind of a weird stat to have," Gibbons said when he learned of his distinction. "The ball must have been traveling well tonight." Well, yeah, it was traveling especially well at Coors Field in Colorado, where the Giants and Rockies combined for 10 home runs in an 18-5 squeaker. In that one, Colorado pitchers set a new club standard for number of home runs surrendered. Said Colorado manager Clint Hurdle, "It was not a good outing." Elsewhere, the White Sox beat the Tigers 17-9, and the Cardinals nipped the Padres 11-5. Nine players hit more than one homer Tuesday. That was also a record. There were four grand slams. According to measuring devices that nobody takes especially seriously, at least 22 of the 62 home runs traveled 400 feet or more. the night of the deluge of dingers does not establish the existence of a conspiracy by the commissioner and other devious powers to ensure more scoring. It doesn't prove that this season's baseballs have centers made of flubber. Recent charges and innuendo notwithstanding, the evening's harvest of homers doesn't demonstrate that 30% or 50% or 80% of the hitters in the big leagues are using steroids. We probably can't even conclude on the basis of one especially wacky evening of whacking baseballs that the reservoir of major league pitching has dropped to drought level. But Tuesday night's goofy numbers lend credibility to those who've been maintaining for some time now that the stats don't mean what they used to mean, that the home run, once a dramatic statement, has become little more than a cliché, that baseball itself, once distinctive for its unique, leisurely pace, has more and more come to resemble pinball. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing depends on your point of view. Maybe 60 or so dingers a night and half a dozen players hitting 65 or 70 home runs a season is the way the game will lure the kids to a sport that's finally beginning to worry that so many of its fans are so much older than fans of basketball and football. Or maybe, in this case, the good old days really were better.
You may play music, you may play baseball, you better hit the right leg, boy. Don't I'll be kicking in your stall if you don't hit your right leg.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Tire and Auto Service, winner of the 2001 Retailer of the Year Award by the Retailers Association of Massachusetts, on the web at directtire.com, and by Yankee Magazine, the magazine of New England living, announcing a redesign including new home, food, garden, and travel features in the summer 2002 issue, on the web at yankeemagazine.com. Good morning, I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Boston Red Sox wore black armbands and the number 9 in honor of Ted Williams. During their 9-5 loss last night at Fenway Park to the Detroit Tigers, the center field flag hung at half-staff and Williams' number 9 was mowed into the left field grass. There was a single red rose in the right field seat, marking the spot where Williams hit the longest home run in Fenway Park history. That seat will remain empty for the rest of the season. The Sox and Tigers will play again this afternoon at Fenway. Pedro Martinez will be on the mound for Boston. Major League Soccer, the New England Revolution host DC United tonight. The Boston Breakers are on the road against San Diego. Be one of the first to see what it looks like to drive through the entire Big Dig Tunnel. Take an exclusive audio and video tour from the Zakim Bunker Hill Bridge in Charlestown to Neyland Street in South Boston. Just log on to WBUR.org and click on Big Dig Tour. Beautiful day in the forecast, sunshine mixing with clouds, highs around 80 with a slight chance of storms.
Hi, this is Alex Chadwick. More than any place I've been in Europe, Venice is travel in time. Walk through the streets of the City of Canals. No cars, no motor scooters, just footsteps, the people around you, history, and a cafe or two. Join me for the next Citizens of the World Tour New Year's in Venice. Travel in time and help pay for the news of today, and what better way to do it?
For more information, call 800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, baseball devotees meet in Boston to discuss, among other matters, Elmer Flick. But first, a look at the week's sports news, including the death yesterday of Ted Williams. We'll discuss this with Charlie Pierce, joining me by phone from South Carolina. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Charlie, Ted Williams generated perhaps more stories than anybody in baseball besides Babe Ruth, but I'm, of course, curious about your take on his life.
Well, Hollywood legend has it that the original title for Citizen Kane was going to be John Citizen American. And that's the first thing that struck me, is that it ought to be Ted Williams American when and if they finally make the movie they should have made years ago. he's a remarkable story. And in a lot of ways, the 20th century is now finally over because one of the last of its heroes is gone. And I mean hero in the fullest sense of the word, not just because he hit a lot of home runs. He was a war hero. He was an absolute archetype. He was as unique in his own way as Babe Ruth was. There was never another American baseball player or any other American citizen quite like Ted Williams. Hmm. Among other things, he was the best at what he did in two different things, and he was one of the best in three. He was probably the best hitter of the baseball who ever lived. Fly fishing aficionados will tell you he was the best fly fisherman who ever lived, and he was one of the best fighter pilots who ever lived.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many people who work their entire lives to do one thing just simply well, let alone one thing better than most people. He managed to do it with three. He's an extraordinary story.
One of the remarkable things along that line, of course, is that he announced when he was still a very, very young man that he intended to be the best hitter who ever lived, and then he went and did it.
More to the point, and this is the lesson that we learn in America from the national anthem to the third verse of Johnny B. Goode. He told everybody else that he was Teddy bleeping ball game, and he wanted them to say as he walked down the street, "There goes Ted Williams, the greatest hitter who ever lived."
Major League Baseball's All-Star Game will occur on Tuesday evening without pitcher Pedro Martinez. He asked out, saying, among other things, that he wanted to save all that he has for the Red Sox. What if every All-Star felt that way?
Well, perhaps there would be a chance for even more Tampa Bay Devil Rays to make the All-Star Game. It is a unique position with pitchers because of the nature of what they do. You know, and there was all this talk that there was actually going to be a boycott as part of a kind of wildcat job action involving this All-Star game. But good for Pedro. I mean, I don't think there's anybody that would fail to understand that in a tight pennant race with the Yankees, he wants to be as fresh as he can be afterwards. I mean, I think, you know, perhaps he should show up and tip his hat, but in terms of actually pitching, you know, good for him.
As you mentioned, Charlie, players won't boycott the All-Star game this year, but union negotiators have said that the players will set a strike date very soon. Maybe the players feel that's a better way to get back at the commissioner.
Well, they don't get, I mean, in any real sense, they don't get at the commissioner if they boycott the All-Star game. First of all, it's not his team, really. It's his daughter's team, remember.
Oh, I'm sorry. A
but,
distinction I overlooked.
I mean, the All-Star game is in itself for the fans, and the All-Star game does contribute to the pension fund. So they would, in essence, be cutting off at least a part of their own nose despite their face. I think the strike date being set is inevitable, but I think it's a separate issue from the All-Star game. I think it's a good idea not to boycott the All-Star game, just politically.
Charlie, we should talk a little bit about Wimbledon, the tennis tournament currently underway in England. Remarkably, the Williams sisters are still being asked to address questions about whether they and their father decide beforehand who will win when they play each other. Why would that question even still come up?
Well, because people need something to talk about besides the incredible, boring wrestling match between accountants that's taking place on the men's side. And because, quite honestly, the two of them have played very unremarkable Grand Slam finals when they have played. There's no epic match, no Borg-McEnroe, no Everett-Navratilova between the two. And until they do play a match where each of them wants to seem to beat the other as intensely as Chris Everett wanted to beat Martina Navratilova or Martina Navratilova wanted to beat Steffi Graf, then you will have the kind of surreptitious mumbling that you have now.
Charlie, Wimbledon didn't work out as well as it might have for English fans. Once again, Tim Henman lost, and I guess the tournament ended a bit early for them.
And good Lord, if he didn't win it this year, he's never going to win it because the draw just fell apart in the early rounds and left him a wide open road to the championship. And now it looks like Leighton Hewitt and, you know, the United Kingdom's most wanted in the men's final. And I guarantee you that the men would sell their grandmothers to the Malay Pirates to have two brothers who beat on each other as hard as the Williams sisters do.
We have got some post-Stanley Cup moves to discuss this week. Apparently, the Detroit Red Wings feel that the goalie acquisition strategy that worked once will work again, and that has set off a kind of chain reaction of goalie signings throughout the National Hockey League. How is this going to affect the league's balance of power?
I suspect not at all. I suspect that the Detroit Red Wings will just be as tough as they were last year. Curtis Joseph is certainly a more than adequate substitution for Dominic Hasek. I think that it's interesting that Mike Richter has stayed with the New York Rangers, who have absolutely no chance of winning the Stanley Cup.
Normally, this would be a time when a great many players were changing teams and making things interesting for basketball fans, but instead, the biggest NBA story seems to be that of the dreaded, perhaps at least, impending luxury tax. Are you disappointed?
Well, I'm not entirely sure how much of this is the actual luxury tax and how much of this is cowardly general managers deciding not to make deals that might get them fired. You know, I always wondered about that with the salary cap in basketball and then with football, whether or not it was simply a way to keep from doing things. There are issues with the salary cap in the NBA that certainly have to be addressed. But all in all, the balance has shifted pretty much to the West in both the NHL and the NBA, and that's simply because the teams are better run there.
Charlie, boxing rarely provides feel-good stories, but we may have one this week in Felix Trinidad's decision to retire. What do you think?
Well, never assume, Bill, because we've all seen this movie before. But Tito Trinidad did lose his aura of invincibility in his last couple of fights, and perhaps he has decided to go out on top. He certainly has enough money. He seems to have been well-managed. As I always say in these situations, I hope he's telling the truth.
We should acknowledge that on his sixth try, Steve Fawcett this week became the first solo balloonist to circle the globe nonstop. And now that there's a record for that trip, do you anticipate a host of other balloonatics trying to break it?
Watch the skies, my son. Watch the skies. I have to confess that this was one I thought nobody would ever do. I thought this was one that just wasn't going to happen. While I congratulate Mr. Fawcett, I'm sort of disappointed. I thought this was going to be the one thing that was, like, beyond the mind of man.
Finally, Charlie, yesterday in Lexington, Kentucky, runners Tim Bailey and Wendy Sagielski ran a portion of the 26th annual Bluegrass 10,000-meter race and stopped briefly for a quick wedding ceremony and finished the race arm in arm. Do you ever find yourself wishing that your wedding had happened at a sports event? And if so, which one would it be?
Absolutely not going to go anywhere near the answer to that question.
Charlie Pierce, cautious as always, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and for Esquire magazine. And, of course, he's been known to supply a great deal of the hot air each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Gee, I don't know, Pitt Road maybe? Nah, forget it.
The bells are ringing for me and my gal. The birds are singing for me and my gal. Everybody's been going to wed.
This week, the Only a Game website facilitated an exchange of opinions about grammar. In last week's letters segment, Ann Stansel complained about the English usage in phrases like Brazil win and Germany lose. Among the many listeners writing to correct Ms. Stansel was Professor Andrew Horn of Curry College and Harvard University. In British English, Professor Horn wrote, the BBC will report that Parliament have met today, while the American media will report that the Senate has met today. I rather prefer the acknowledgement that legislatures, teams, and other corporate bodies are actually made up of people. Michelle Seaton's report on women learning to shoot generated considerable response. Marlon B. Klinger, who hears Only a Game on WAMK in Kingston, New York, was, he wrote, thrilled. It was probably the only even-handed evaluation of the topic I've ever heard. I'm a member of the NRA, and I'm tired of persons who spread misrepresentations and false descriptions of America's gun owners. I think my neighbors were probably startled to see me jump into the air and click my heels as I listened on my Walkman. Hap Rocchetto of Westerly, Rhode Island, also enjoyed the piece, though he objected to the use of Ethel Merman singing You Can't Get a Man with a Gun at the end of it. On the other hand, Karen Arthur thought the music choice was, quote, perfect. Of the same story, Julie Moran of Schenectady, New York, asked, how did this NRA's flak attack turn into an infomercial on Only a Game? Safety with firearms, an answer to the statistics that household firearms are far more likely to kill family members and friends than enemies? Do a real women's sports feature. Dr. Gary Gordon, who hears the program on WHYY in Philadelphia, agrees. "I love your show," he wrote, "but the story on guns was a mistake. This is not about sports. It's about the NRA doing everything it can to promote the sale of guns. It has turned this country into a tragic freak show where the number of deaths involving children or suicide is staggering. Your promoting this piece as a cute story of women learning how to shoot guns is not wise unless the show changes from only a game to only a killing field." Your comments will reach us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is oag@wbur.bu.edu. If you visit our website, onlyagame.org, you can click on Contact and send us your thoughts that way. You can also leave your words on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Baseball has long been known as the best game for fans who most appreciate history and statistics. The Major League game is over 100 years old, and over those years, baseball's chroniclers have devised ways to quantify everything the players do. Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor recently visited with some of the keepers of that particular flame at the 32nd Annual Convention of the Society for American Baseball Research, and he returned with this report.
Also, the committee bypassed John Clarkson, who won, I believe, 328 Major League games. In 1939, the committee had elected Charlie Radbourne to the Hall of Fame. If you put their statistics together, as you can see, they have almost identical statistics. In fact, Clarkson got three more outs in his career than Radbourne.
Can you love something too much?
They have almost identical stats, except that
Boston's ornate and stately Park Plaza Hotel has been the temporary home to many celebrities and dignitaries. Rich, handsome, and well-dressed couples stroll through the lobby all day, every day, except today. Today, the Park Plaza is Sabres domain. The Armani-clad model has been replaced by the guy with the St. Louis Browns jersey, blue shorts, and skinny legs. The image of the stereotypical Saberite is that of a pale, bookish, middle-aged white guy. But there were several bookish, middle-aged women, as well as some who didn't quite know what century they were living in.
I lived vicariously through the actions of the 1890s.
While some here fit the baseball geek stereotype, some don't, if you look closely enough. Gabriel Schechter was a poker dealer in Las Vegas for 15 years before he became a baseball researcher and author. Now he prefers the quieter life of baseball statistics and Sabre conventions.
One way to look at it is that the people who research and study baseball history are very sane people compared to the people I met in casinos in Las Vegas.
Joseph Hetrick and David Nemec have also found refuge in the relatively stable world of baseball history. They don't even bother with baseball that came along after 1900.
Well, the pennant races are always secure. You always know who's going to win. And the guys that you write about don't come after you. They're dead.
Bob, I'm going to buy these two.
Okay. All right. Those are some of the last of my originals there.
Uh-huh. Bob Keeler sits among stacks of old Milwaukee Brewers collectibles and peddles the rare pictures and programs he's gathered over the years. Keeler thinks the stats of yesterday can bring a fan hope for his or her team tomorrow.
It's always nice to support a winning team, and it takes a little more effort to support a team that's losing. But that's one thing with baseball and statistics. You can go back to the good old days when they did have good teams and sort of help boost your confidence that the team will come back and win the pennant again.
Some Saberites undoubtedly use baseball research to escape, but John Blackburn of Santa Fe, California, says it helped him through a difficult childhood.
I grew up with a very, very bad speech impediment, and about the only thing I felt comfortable talking about was baseball, and that was with my grandmother, So when you have a bad speech impediment, you know, kids do ridicule you and everything, but I could always talk baseball to my grandmother.
I would think Morgan Bulkley is the least deserving member of the hall.
Blackburn and his giggling middle-aged colleagues pack conference rooms transfixed by the presentations on modern managing techniques and early flaws of the Hall of Fame voting system.
Well, I've been doing some research on people like Elmer Flick. I'm working on a book about, you know, how everyone knows Babe Ruth and Willie Mays. Who's ever heard of Elmer Flick?
This is Saber. everyone's hand goes up. Some might find Saber's dedication to baseball research slightly disturbing, or just a waste of time. But Gabriel Schechter finds it worthwhile.
I think we come from a generation that took the game more seriously. It was the game was presented just as a game, and now it's marketed and it's more commercialized, and so I think the young generation doesn't take it as seriously yet. But when you get to a certain age, you figure out what you love in life, and these are the people who love baseball.
Can you love something too much? Maybe. But the members of Sabre don't think so. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Tina Toby, Gennady Giller, and Paul Lavallier at CBC Ottawa. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Hall of Fame broadcaster Kurt Gowdy, calling Ted Williams last at bat.
One out, nobody on, last of the eighth inning. Jack Fisher into his windup. Here's the pitch. Williams swings, and there's a long drive to deep right. That ball is going, and it is gone. A home run for Ted Williams in his last time at bat in the major league.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR, Weekend Edition.